football is back.
Aguero makes it three. Chelsea switch off at the back.
Like the rest of us returning to work, the Premier League is also back. Keep up to date with the latest scores on the OTB Sports app. Live updates and analysis of this summer's Premier League action. The OTB Sports app. Live score updates straight to your phone. The OTB Podcast Network.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
And a very good morning to you. Welcome along to OTB AM. We're here with you every morning from 7:30 all the way through until 10 o'clock. It's Ger Gilroy with you. And my virtual co-host this morning is none other than Dave McIntyre. Dave, how the hell are you?
I'm very well, Ger. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm very good. Back after a couple of weeks of R&R, they call it when you're at home with your kids these days.
And have you got a newfound perspective on life? You're relaxed. All the stresses and tribulations of life have evaporated from your mind and you're a brand new you starting this morning.
Well, you know, I mean, you always try and come back supercharged. Isn't that how this thing works? And until
that's the theory.
The daily grind breaks you down. football's back in the Premier League over a space of essentially 5 days now. And I think the big winner from all of this has been fans. The fact that they are so integral to the well-being of the game, to what our sense of what it means to be a football supporter or watcher or consumer. That whole notion of the fans as the crop to be cultivated by the football clubs, yeah, and to have their money taken essentially for the value of them wanting to show up for their loyalty. I think all that, I really hope that fans are going to start flexing their muscles a bit more into the future.
So do you feel that if, for example, in some terrible, nightmarish, hypothetical situation, this was to go on for a number of years, that the game would be irreparably damaged or that clubs would just move on?
Well, I don't think that they'll have to come up with some alternative where virtual fans are making live virtual reactions to what's happening as opposed to pre-recorded crowd noise. It struck me yesterday, I was listening to the Villa game on the radio. We obviously had live commentary of it. And with, I think, about 5 minutes left to go, Damien Delaney makes the point. 2-1 down, at home, lumping the ball forward. This is exactly where, and they've just won a free kick, this is exactly where the Villa fans are up on there. The whole down, they're like, come on! Instead, it's eerie silence. And he's like, oh, look, Chelsea are just going to see this out. And they did. They did just see it out.
Yeah.
So there's a pointlessness, it feels like, to games without supporters in some ways.
Yeah, players are still wheeling away from the goal mouth after they put the ball into the back of the net to celebrate with fans that aren't there. It takes them a half a second to realise what the new normal is. And look, yeah, if you're looking at a pretty example of the importance of fans, just have a look at that Merseyside derby last night, which is probably the worst Merseyside derby I've ever watched. And I've been watching them for the gut to 35 years. And it was terrible. It's one of those games that goes into the category of there's 2 hours of my life that I'll simply never get back. And we know how important the crowd is to the Merseyside derby. So, yeah, look, it doesn't paint a pretty picture of what football could be like into the long term if this is the way it's going to go. You pray that fans will be allowed back in the short term. I think Everton will be happy enough. For some clubs, not playing in front of their home fans at times is a blessing. I don't think it affected Everton too much yesterday. They haven't done much against Liverpool at home in 10 years. But definitely from a team in the bottom three that is desperate to make something happen in the last 5 minutes, and you've got the Holt End at Villa Park roaring you on. Huge significance there, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Right, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of some of these football stories a little bit later on with Gary Breen. I'm going to tell you what's coming up on the show. 8:10 this morning, Gary Breen is going to join us. We'll do the sports pages around about 8:35. Alan Quinlan's going to join us to talk about a bit of rugby around about 8:50 this morning. And then the BMW Run and Ride in aid of Pieta House, our cycling coach, Michael Black, is going to join us. So if you have any questions about getting good value from your cycling, then feel free to get in touch with us. You can WhatsApp us, 087 9180 180 is the number, or you can always tweet the show at Off the Ball. And then Mount Rushmore today is Fermanagh. Declan Bogue and Colin Bradley have been charged with picking the four heads that we'll carve into the side of a mountain in Fermanagh. Or the side of a hill, maybe? Or floated up from a lake in Fermanagh? Maybe that's what we do on hot air balloons. Maybe that's the way that works. So that's what's coming up on the show for you this morning between now and 10 o'clock. As ever, we'd love to hear from you. Use the hashtag OTBAM. Let's get some reaction from the return of the Premier League over the course of the weekend. We had two live games on the OTB Sports app. Newcastle beat Sheffield United 3-0. Stephen and Damien Delaney were on duty for that one, for the Villa-Chelsea game. Nathan and Brian Kerr were on duty for the Newcastle-Sheffield United game. Here's what Brian Kerr and first Damien Delaney made of the weekend's football. Have a look.
Former Republic of Ireland international Damien Delaney, we've just been watching the action at Villa Park, 2-1 win for Chelsea. I suppose when we saw what happened in the first half, we were thinking, well, it's a Chelsea win all day. Do you think there was any doubt in their minds going into the dressing room once they conceded that goal to Aston Villa, or they've been confident all along they would still see the game out and get the win?
I think managers like Frank Lampard set a game plan in place, and if his players can execute it, he knows that 99 times out of 100 they'll win the game. Now, even if they go behind, he won't panic, because if they go behind and the players aren't implementing what he wants, that means they're losing because things aren't going as he planned. But I thought that first half went exactly as he planned, apart from the goal. And he knows that on the law of averages, if they go out in the second half, he's been a part of enough Chelsea teams where they won games late. He knows that if they keep asking the right questions, keep knocking away, eventually the rewards will come, because Villa can't hold out. Not when the possession is 75% and above. And I know you said at the start of the second half, it was up to 90-10 at one point. Nobody can withstand that. Eventually, the door's going to open.
Would you say that win now is enough for Chelsea to kind of think, this top four place is ours, we will be in the Champions League next season? They still have a bit more to do, do you think?
The thing I say is, who behind them is going to put a run together to catch them? So I'm not saying that they're home and hosed just yet, but I think that they've put themselves in a position where they can, even if they have a little spell where they draw two games, the ones behind them aren't winning, seven out of eight games. Man United aren't putting together a run like that. Spurs aren't, or Arsenal aren't putting a run together like that. I mean, maybe someone like a Crystal Palace or a Sheffield United or Wolverhampton is what you'd be worried about, because maybe they could, under the radar, put that type of a run together, but it'd be a surprise. So all Chelsea need to do now is maintenance. Just keep tipping away, keep adding the wins, keep getting a couple of draws. With a 5-point cushion, they have a little bit of wriggle room where if they do have a bad couple of results, they'll still be okay.
Big game for them on Thursday against Manchester City coming up. That one at Stamford Bridge. Look, we know home form doesn't seem to hold any water when teams are playing behind closed doors. We've seen it in Germany. It seems to be happening in the Premier League as well. What are Chelsea hoping for from that game? Well, obviously 3 points, but against a really good Manchester City team, do you think they will beat them on Thursday night?
I think this Chelsea team are kind of in its infancy of doing something good. They really have put a good plan in place. They've put a good transfer kind of system in place where they're buying young players. And although they lost to Bayern Munich, and they'll more than likely lose the second leg as well, and games like Manchester City, I think Frank Lampard will be using those as a learning curve for the future, so that his young players are used to playing in big games, used to come up against calibre of opposition of a Bayern Munich and a Manchester City and a Liverpool. So when they play against them afterwards, you can say, that's a level we've got to get to, because they are out in front of us at the moment. So while he will be looking for 3 points, he'll also be thinking this is an invaluable experience for the likes of Mason Mount, the likes of Ruben Loftus-Cheek and Ross Barkley, saying to these guys, look, this is the standard we got to get to, and then with Timo Werner coming in next season, they're definitely on the road to getting there. So he will be looking for 3 points, but I think he won't be expecting a whole pile.
I'll come back to Timo Werner. You mentioned during the commentary about the FA Cup, and it's a really good chance for Lampard to get a trophy in his first season. Do you think he'll go all out to try and get that FA Cup win?
I think the Champions League will be a priority, but with the cushion he's given himself, I definitely think that he will now be looking for all guns out, going for the FA Cup, because again, it's part of the learning curve for these young guys that he's assembling, with the likes of Pulisic. Can they get to a cup final? And can they experience a cup final? Insofar as, even if they win or lose it, if they win, they could say, okay, we've got a trophy under our belt. If they lose it, they can say, okay, listen, we still got a little bit to go and we still want to win cup competitions. So for these guys to play in games of that magnitude, the Manchester City's, Bayern Munich's, FA Cup finals, that's the kind of their next stepping stone, really.
You mentioned Timo Werner. He's coming in for a big price tag, just under 60 million. A lot of people wondered about the Roman Abramovich project. He's not around London these days, whether his heart was fully in the Chelsea setup, whether he might have been considering selling the club onto another club owner. But he seems to be putting money into the club again. He's investing in players. Timo Werner comes in at a big price tag. Which player in that Chelsea team is most worried about his position? Because you don't pay that amount of money for a player to sit on the bench.
No, he's going to come in and play, and it's pretty obvious who he's going to play. I think he's going to play up front, and maybe not a traditional number nine, but he's definitely going to play in probably looking at today's team, instead of Giroud as a number nine, or maybe Willian, you know, because Willian's getting on now, and I know he's a contract issue there as well, insofar as whether he's going to stay or not. So, but again, a player of that quality coming in is going to elevate Chelsea to another level again. With Abramovich, I think he's realised that he can't keep pouring money at the rate that he was in. They've got a strategy now, you know, and I know the Timo Werner money probably offset by the Morata money. So yeah. has he really just put 60 million of his own? He's not. I think he's probably said years ago, I'm not doing this anymore. We can't just keep going out buying the top talent in the world, because, you know, although he's a very wealthy man, he's not, you know, state backed, which some teams are now. So he's realised that he can't compete in that end where he can go and spend 200 million. Back in the early 2000s, he could just come in and spend 50 million, and nobody could do that back then. So he kind of changed the game. So they've realised this, and they've gone down a different route, you know, where we have to sell to generate money, and we're going to buy young players. And if we can sell on players at their peak and make 80, 90, 100 million off them, then we'll reinvest that in young players. And I think that was their strategy for a long time now. But look, Timo Werner is a fantastic player. He fits really well with what Chelsea are trying to do. And it's great to see a club with a really good transfer strategy.
Speaking of money and spending money, Aston Villa spent a lot of it at the start of this season. And if you spend that amount of money, you would expect to be staying in the Premier League. But we've seen it so many times, Damien, with teams coming up and blowing a load of money on players and can't seem to fit those players into a steady kind of system where they get good results. So was a mistake by Villa now in hindsight? I know it's easy to make these assessments in hindsight, but when you look back, did they buy too many players? Did they spend too much money? Should they maybe have put more faith in the players that got them promoted?
Well, look, when we got promoted at Crystal Palace, we pretty much kept the nucleus of what we had. Mm. And we said, we're going to go at it with what we're good at, which is, you know, defensively strong, counter-attacking football. And these are our principles. We want to stick with it. Fulham tried it a couple of years ago. They went up and blew all this money. And I know the manager there said afterwards that they did that wrong. Even the club admitted, we shouldn't have done that. We should have stuck with what we had. And I did catch you say at the start of the second half that Dean Smith spent 140 million, you know, and I was going to pull you up and say, well, did he really? Was it Dean Smith that spent it? I'd be surprised, you know. I could picture Dean Smith sitting in his office and, you know, one of these players walks in the door and he actually has to go, who's that? And that happens, believe it or not, in football, where like director of football goes, oh, that's Samata, he's our new centre forward. And he's gone, who? And then all of a sudden he's scrambling, but somebody get some clips of this guy. And I know stories where that has actually happened in football before. I've seen that actually happen. So did he really spend it? Did he have much choice in the route the club were going down? Because a lot of these wealthy owners that own football clubs now, they don't want to hand it over to a manager or a director of football that they don't know. A lot of them come with their own directors of football that put their plan in place and the manager has to deal with it. And Dean Smith's job basically is put out fires. But you can watch Villa today. They're very, very passive. Even in the last 10 minutes, there wasn't a whole lot in what they did. They never really pinned Chelsea in. You know, normally when you're 2-0 down at home, and you can blame the crowd for this if you want, but you're 2-0 down, 2-1 down at home with 5 minutes to go, could take the shackles off and really pin Chelsea in. It never came, which just lets me know that psychologically, they I don't want to say they rolled over, but in a sense they kind of did. They just accepted the 2-1 defeat, really. And at one point there, Chelsea had 7, 8, 9, 10 passes in the corner, and no Villa player stuck a leg in or fouled or did anything. You know, they just kind of let the, you know, we're 2-1 down 10 minutes ago, I will accept this one and move on. And their traits of a team that got relegated, you know, at least if they had a go and they just, you know, said, oh, I'm not having this really, I'm going to go and nail someone here, win the ball back and really try and pin Chelsea in. And maybe we'll get lucky, maybe we'll get a penalty, we'll get a deflection or something will happen. It never came because they never asked the questions, and that's why I would worry for Villa. The only thing is their two worst teams, because Norwich are gone, is their two worst teams.
Yeah.
I think West Ham possibly might be a bit softer than Villa. I think that Watford don't look like they're going in the great, so I think it's two from those three, really.
And Bournemouth maybe as well, because you throw in
there. Well, there you go, man. I mean, they look like right in trouble as well, but again, if they stay up, it won't be with anything they've done. It'll just be there'll be two worst teams in them that were potentially softer. But looking at Villa today, pretty soft, they look wishy-washy, they don't have any real dogs in their team, they don't have any real, I don't use the term leaders, but, you know, characters, you know, we're getting beat here, I'm not having this, and I'm just going to go and do something. Grealish had a little go at the end, but, like, I mean, it just seemed to happen, and they let it happen, and it just fizzled out.
And as well, when you're in that situation, it's so important to have somebody who can score goals, and it just hasn't worked out for Villa like that. Wesley, as we know, is injured now, but he was struggling to find the net. They bring in Samata in January. I know he scored in his debut against Bournemouth, but he's gone now. He has 5 games now without a goal. I know it's a short amount of time, and he could still come good in the last eight games now of the season, but that's such an important thing, isn't it? Having a goal scorer in these last few matches.
But they don't create any chances. So yeah. While it's important having a goal scorer, you've got to give them something. I mean, you know, Davis was on, and I know that they got Samata. But they, you know, your wide players were playing as fullbacks today. It's very, very hard to create chances. It's very, very hard to give these guys something to feed off. It's hit and miss stuff because they're a nice, pretty team in their own half. You know, the midfield players like dropping and getting off the centre-backs and making great little passes in their own half, where it counts is in the Chelsea's defensive third, and they just don't do that for me. They just have a lack of cutting edge, a lack of character, a lack of personality in that team, and that's what happens when you bring together 10, 12 players who weren't there last year. You're trying to settle everybody in, and I just think that they're, you know, obviously a lot of money around that football club, and it just seems to be a bit wishy-washy for me.
You mentioned, if we go back to the top four battle and the impact this Chelsea result will have, and I know you might have your doubts over Manchester United. They did have a good run before the break. The break probably came at the worst time for them. They just beaten City in the derby, which is a big, big result for them. But there's been a lot of talk about Paul Pogba coming back and perhaps the link up between himself and Fernandes. Can they, you know, prove to be a good partnership for United? Or is Fernandes the kind of player that he's the star man and Pogba could perhaps upset what he was doing before the break?
I don't think so. I think those two players will find a way to work together. Scoring goals is a problem for Manchester United. Mm. I think Martial gets away with it for me. I think he's lazy. He's immobile. He's very, very disinterested for large portions of the game. Even the other night I was watching him, very, very static. There's not a whole lot of creativity in the fullback area. Armand Bissaka is a very, very good defender. Is he like Aspilicueta today, where he set up two goals, you know, causing all sorts of damage? And Marcus Alonso as well with his 25-30 crosses. I'm not sure Luke Shaw is either on the other side. Decent players, don't get me wrong, but is there enough creativity? Sorry, there is enough creativity with Fernandes and Pogba, but there are enough people to get on the end of it, and is there enough people to score the goals that they're going to require? Because I almost feel like United will concede goals. So is there enough, you know, for them to get two or three goals a game? I don't think they're that type of team, and they're not set up for 1-0 wins. So they kind of have a lot of attacking players, but I just don't see them getting two or three goals a game.
So it looks like, you know, the top three is sewn up: City, Liverpool, and Leicester City. You would have to say probably have that other spot sealed off. Although you never know, there's still a small gap between them and Chelsea. But if you were looking at it that way, like, who else can you see getting into the top four apart from Liverpool and City? Is it Chelsea definitely going to get?
I think Chelsea will sew up that fourth spot. But I think if there was a challenger to come for it, it'll probably come from Wolves.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's, everyone's focusing on United, Spurs, Arsenal, you know, and there's a lot of like negativity as, oh, which one of them's going to get the fourth spot? I think it could be Wolves. If there's any team could put a run together, I think it's them, where they could put pressure on Chelsea. I don't think they've got enough to catch them, because I think Chelsea will win enough games and keep that cushion that they already have. But I know Man City have their problems with UEFA, so there could be a fifth spot available. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah. So if City do get thrown out of Europe, I mean, I think Wolves could get that fifth spot.
And they seem to be, Wolves are one of the more complete teams out of those teams. They've got really solid defence, good goalkeeper in Patricio, good midfield, and up front they've got an array of talent, the likes of Jota, Jimenez, of course, and Adama Traore.
A well-oiled machine. He has his principles, he has his way, how he wants to attack, how he wants to defend, and you can see straight away the game they played, they just picked it up straight away. You know, they're very, very well drilled. There's nothing probably left to chance or nothing off the cuff for them. He's very well organised, very diligent, and I think he expects the same of his players.
And to finish, just your general thoughts on what we've seen so far this weekend, the Premier League coming back. Like, I know it's tough not having the crowds there, and it's hard for the supporters who support their team right through the season not to be able to be there. Maybe the Bundesliga kind of set us up for it well. I find I'm getting used to it a bit more. Yeah. What's your own thoughts on how the matches have gone?
It has to finish, just from a financial point of view, and I don't think anyone really cares of how it finishes, because Liverpool are going to be champions, so it just needs to finish, and we all just need to just, you know, stop complaining and just... July the 15th, it's less than a month, get the games out of the way and we start again next season. But I wouldn't look too much into this weekend, to be honest with you. You know, it is like first game of the season, and in my experience, first game of the season it's very, very rarely two or three games in is usually the same team that's playing or results, you know, pick up, you know, because players have had such a long time off. Some teams might have got their fitness regimes wrong and they might get to work on certain things. I don't know. But let's just all get behind it, get it over the line and start again next year.
All right, so a convincing victory for Newcastle in the first game of the day. 3-0 win over Sheffield United. And as we go around the UK to Premier League matches, we always take a keen interest in the Irish and we always take great pride when they grab a goal or they perform well. Unfortunately, today wasn't one of those days. It was a bad old day for John Egan and Enda Stevens.
Yeah, McGoldrick didn't make the squad. He obviously wasn't fit after the knock he got coming on sub the other night against Aston Villa. And then it didn't go well for John Egan. Obviously, the yellow card in the first half, it might have been a little bit harsh. It was a nothing incident. It wasn't like it was a foul or a kick. It was a row over a free kick that was awarded to Sheffield United. And he got involved with Joe Linton. The referee decided to give both of them yellow cards, but that was costly for him. In the second half, went up against Joe Linton. He probably got a little bit too tight to him. We probably need to hear what Damien Delaney or Gary Breen, the centre-halves union, have to say about it. But initially, he was right up against some long boot forward from Newcastle player there with a penalty here. He got the first touch with his right leg around Joe Linton's body, but the ball broke off Joe Linton's body into his path and it looked like he was going to get away from John Egan, but he held him, and he held him probably too often. He had a couple of snatches at him and the referee decided that he did foul him, and that proved to be crucial in the game because then the Stevens made a bad error from Matt Ritchie's attempted pass that Enda Stevens tried to cut it out and it went between his legs as he tried to kick it with his right foot into the path of the pass went into the path of Sam Maximan. He scored, and the opening goal was crucial in this game for two teams that don't score a lot of goals. Newcastle 25 before today and Sheffield United just 30, so the opening goal was very important, and obviously with the 10 men Newcastle went on from there to win 3-0.
Sheffield United could have gone fifth with a win. They now go to Old Trafford to play Manchester United on Wednesday. That's a huge game for them if they are to somehow squeeze into a Champions League place. They've been the story. Newcastle often get forgotten about in the way they're nicely in mid-table now, but they got their goals, and three attacking players got their goals for once. Joe Linton, first in quite a while, first at St James's Park for him in the Premier League. Steve Bruce getting enough credit?
Probably not. You know, he's got a lot of criticism, I think, from Newcastle fans who are probably over-expectant. They don't always realise how ordinary many of their players are. And I think Steve Bruce has extracted almost the maximum from them. I'm not sure that Joe Linton was his choice. It was a lot of money spent on him, 40 million. Sam Maximum, they're getting good value from him. Another goal today, that's three. It took him a while to get going. He didn't score until December, I think, was his first goal. Joe Linton's last goal was it, we saw it against Spurs in early in the season, September maybe, was it?
August, I think, yeah.
Was it? They won 1-0 away at Spurs. And so he gets a goal there. But his all-round game today, I thought, was quite good. And the three of them together, Almiron played well. Matt Ritchie got a good goal, good finish, good strike. But Sheffield United were off today. Newcastle were better. 38 points, that will be safe. I think 37 has been enough for the majority of the last 10 seasons. So 38 will be enough for them this season to see them safe. And so now they can be looking, can we get a little bit further up the table rather than looking down? A good few seasons it's been looking down, looking behind for them. Are we going to be safe? So I think Steve Bruce done a good job.
A lot of people have watched a lot of football this weekend. Every match suddenly. On the television, and of course tuning in on Off the Ball on the radio, I'm sure. Taking a break on the... Just tune in on the app and you can
go for a drive.
Exactly. That's it. Keeps everybody happy is the only thing we could advise. From what I know from talking to you around it, you haven't overly enjoyed the behind closed doors experience. Just in terms of performances, though, what stood out over the weekend?
Well, I think Newcastle's result has been a bit of a standout. I think Arsenal's two defeats are quite shocking, even by Arsenal standards. The fact that they blew the new Brighton match, haven't gone ahead. I suppose Wolves coming back, you know, so much coming back, but finding a way to win that game, get two goals when it looked like it was petering out into nothing against West Ham, just confirms their season so far that it's not a flash in the pan.
Who wins a 100 metre sprint between Adama Traore and Alan Saint-Maximin?
Well, I think Traore's been doing it for a lot longer. I mean, I can remember him playing with Middlesbrough a few years back, playing in the front position and running like, you know, running like a very fast hare, but not running in any great direction, running like a hare that was trying to avoid the hounds. But now there seems to be a lot more logic to what he does when he's on the ball, a lot more effectiveness, and he is really a key player for them. Come on and change the game yesterday. But some good performances, but some very mediocre performances so far, and I think the players will need a game or two to get back into the rhythm of their combination players, of their understanding between each other and their, the best of their touch.
What about Friday night, Manchester United against Tottenham? There's obviously a huge amount of criticism from Roy Keane in particular for Harry Maguire and David De Gea for the first goal, but then a lot of praise for what Paul Pogba did in the second half and just how good that combination of himself and Bruno Fernandes could be. With Kenny Cunningham on yesterday saying he thinks that those two as a midfield could potentially spark United into being real title challengers next season.
Well, I think that was the best match of the weekend in terms of technical ability, tactical play, change of fortunes, Spurs getting the goal, looking dangerous on the break, Manchester United dominating possession, missing a couple of opportunities, but finding it hard to break through when Spurs sat back in the second half, having got the lead goal. They probably sat back too far. Pogba come on and had an impact, just as you talked about Traore there, had a real impact in the game, seemed to be a spark already. And I heard Bruno Fernandes talking after the match about that they've hit it off, they work together in training, they've been in the same small walking group, he said, and that's clever by Solskjaer to do that, to ensure they're trying to develop an understanding. But isn't it sad that we're talking about Pogba, but he's not made an impact this season, that he's played so little, and all that controversy, is he injured, is he not injured, is it sore ankle, is he getting better, is he going to be back, is he going to be fit, is he going to leave? It's always,
it's hard to get carried away in half an hour.
Yeah, it is, but he's a good player, Pogba, he's not consistent enough, he needs to do it for a long period, he needs to do it game after game, he needs to be a match winner more often. But Fernandes has showed he's a player, and he is a better player than what Manchester United have been using for the last couple of seasons in those attacking positions from midfield. He can see a pass, he can play a pass, and he can shoot. He's taken penalties. Most of his goals have been set pieces so far, but he's had a real impact since he's come along, and there's a lot of potential there in that pairing.
Another quiet weekend as well in the life of Roy Keane. He'd be swinging punches in the United dressing room at halftime, leaving the two lads behind when the bus is home. Keith Andrews is a bullshitter.
Look, you know, Roy has been a manager and he knows what it's like. He's been a player. He knows what that's like. Now he's a pundit. Mm. And he's doing his punditry in his own way. I think it certainly gives headlines. But I didn't think his analysis at halftime was particularly incisive or logical. I mean, yes, Luke Shaw should have done a bit better in that moment, and Maguire could have done a bit better, and certainly it was a mistake by De Gea, but it kind of overlooked how brilliant the play was by Bergwijn to come up with that. And also that over a period of time, Maguire has been a good player for Manchester United this season. Luke Shaw has had a fairly decent season also, and De Gea for years has been a very good goalkeeper for United. Is he overrated, as Roy says? I don't think he's overrated. I think he's let in some soft goals this season, and as we said in commentary today, he's going to be under pressure by Dean Henderson. But talking about, you know, throwing punches at half time at the dressing room and so on, I don't think that does Roy any favours. It grabs a headline if the media want to use him for headlines and for sensationalism at half time and after matches, so be it. But would it be attractive to clubs to take him on as a manager if they thought that's how he actually reacts at half time to someone making mistakes? I don't think so. But, you know, look, everyone has their own style. Everyone does it their own way. And, you know, Roy's way is a bit different.
Yeah. Well, you've been in a dressing room with him. Did you ever see him swinging punches?
I was the manager, though.
I understand
that. I was the manager. He was the player.
But even as a player...
No, we didn't have, you know, look, I was fortunate enough to manage Roy for a few matches with Ireland when he eventually came back, and his behaviour and outlook and influence was excellent, you know, around the team, in the training, on the pitch. I mean, he wasn't at his best at that time. He was still suffering from some of the previous injuries he's had, but he still had an impact. But it was only a short part in his career, and we got on very well. He got on very well with all the staff and all the players during that period, and, you know, he was a great servant of Ireland when he played in the matches. He had a great impact. He's one of our greatest ever players. And he's moved on now with his career. And, he, you know, having probably said he never wanted to be a pundit, he is a pundit, and he attracts a lot of attention. And he sees the game very clearly, and he sees the game very well too.
Yeah, you've done all right. You haven't got the tongue lashing just yet.
I haven't read the books. Maybe no, it's in there in the books.
I think you did. Okay. It was McAteer was the problem, wasn't that it?
With me?
Let's not go there again. We've already done that.
Never read any of them. It doesn't bother me at all.
All right, Brian, good stuff. We're going to be back Wednesday night, Liverpool against Crystal Palace, potentially the title decider for Liverpool. So we'll talk to you then.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
OTB's Mount Rushmore. 32 counties, one county representative choosing their sporting Mount Rushmore.
I'm going to be very unpopular. Thank God we can't go too far. I might have to go back into lockdown.
The bad news is they're all from Waterford.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
You just need to put a health warning with it.
And catch the live decision making over the next few months on OTB AM, live every weekday at 7:30 AM on OTB Sports Radio.
OTB AM.
Declan Bogue and Colin Bradley are going to do Fermanagh's Mount Rushmore this morning. If you've got any thoughts on that, that's coming your way at around about 10 past 9. We're going to talk rugby with Alan Quinlan a little bit later on as well. If you have any questions for him, you can WhatsApp us. 087-9180-180 is the number. It's 2 minutes past 8 here this morning on OTB AM. It's Gerry Gilroy and Dave McIntyre with you all the way through until 10. Dave, did you watch every single football match? Did you sit there and kind of like, oh my God, my eyes are square at the end of football? Or are you slowly getting back into the rhythm of plonking yourself in front of the TV and watching a lot of football?
I've watched a lot of sport. I watched 2.5 full games. I watched half the Villa-Sheffield United game. I saw all of Tottenham-Manchester United. And I watched all of the Merseyside Derby last night. And then I've obviously gone through all the highlights and seen the goals and the various talking points from the other games. And I've watched probably more golf than I have in the last couple of years in terms of regular PGA Tour events. So I have managed to get plenty of time on the couch to do my best to catch up and gorge myself on what was on offer. So yeah, I've quickly eased myself back in. It's been enjoyable.
I haven't seen any of the Sunday golf actually, so I don't know what the impact of not having crowds on Sunday when there's money on the line. It did seem to me like the first few days of the golf, it didn't really matter that there were no fans there, because you're kind of not used to huge crowds on a Thursday or a Friday. And sometimes on a Saturday, the crowds are grand, but they don't seem to matter in golf as much.
Yeah, I think the bigger the tournament it is, the more the crowds play a role. Like the Masters, the Ryder Cup, the Open Championship, having the crowds there are huge. And hearing roars from around the golf course on the back nine on the Sunday when a player is standing over a shot maybe in the middle of a fairway, that adds to the TV side of it immensely during those bigger tournaments. But we've been watching regular PGA Tour, regular European Tour events for years where there were virtually no spectators. Look at any of the events in the Middle East on the Thursday and the Friday on the European Tour. There's been nobody there watching them, bar a smattering of tourists or expats that might be standing around the back of the green. So in terms of what we've watched last week at the Colonial and this week at the Heritage in Hilton Head, it doesn't make a blind bit of difference. It hasn't taken away from my enjoyment at all. And if anything, it kind of adds to the intrigue. I don't know how much of you saw of the event in Texas last weekend, but there were three or four missed putts from inside 4 feet, and the eerie silence when the golfer is staring at the hole and can't believe the putt has gone in. Normally you would obviously have a huge groan or some encouraging shouts in the crowd, but I think it actually added to the suspense and the tension at times. So it's a two-way street in some regards on in the lesser events. But like football, there are moments where you desperately do miss the crowds in and around the greens and the fairways. So that will change hopefully soon enough. I think there's only four events down to go crowdless. Now, whether that changes, and given the situation in the States and the rather worrying figures emerging from many of the states in the US, that remains to be seen.
Yeah, look, who knows what the hell they're going to do. I think that is definitely a movable feast. As it stands, the plan is to have fans at the Ryder Cup. There clearly won't be any Europeans. I mean, I suppose there's loads of Europeans who probably live in America who might be able to go. If the Ryder Cup couldn't have fans, are you in the kick it back a year and like, what's the big deal camp? Or are you in the, we need a Ryder Cup this year for the sense of normality?
Yeah, I would probably kick it back a year. I'm a huge fan of the Ryder Cup, and I would have it up there with the Masters as in the top two or three golf events. The fact that it's every 2 years makes it extra special, but the crowds at the Ryder Cup are of vital importance to me, and I would be happy enough to wait 3 years for a Ryder Cup if it meant that we could have a full golf course and full galleries, full grandstands. Look, it wouldn't be unprecedented. They obviously kicked it back a year after 9/11, and the Ryder Cup that was always played in even odd years before that. So we could just go back to odd years, and then you bump the Presidents come back here. It's not the end of the world. If it came to a decision as to whether to go the Whistling Straits this September with no fans, I would be an advocate for postponing it. But I'm sure there are plenty that would have an opinion contrary to that. Any Ryder Cup is better than no Ryder Cup, some people might say. So either way, if it's played this year, I'll be reasonably happy. But yeah, if the decision was to push it back a year, I would go down that road.
We were speaking about this around about 7:30 this morning when we started the show. But in terms of the quality of the football being impacted by the absence of fans, I think it's quite clear that the fans have a really important role to play in how we interpret and watch and listen to football matches. That actually, one of the things that struck me was that one of the benefits of multiple screens when you're watching football is that it's grand because you can be on your phone, and when the crowd noise alerts you to something, as opposed to the commentators, I realise that Dave, you know, as a commentator, you might take some offence to this, but then actually it's the crowd going wah, you look up, you're like, okay, grand, I need to see this now. That's gone. So I think a lot of people are going to be watching a lot more football, slightly more intently, and you know, some of the football that we're watching at the moment isn't going to be of the very highest quality because these players haven't played a lot of games just recently.
So are you saying the superimposed, glued-in crowd noise doesn't get you to look up from your phone when there's a slightly delayed ooh and ah because a ball is hit the post or something?
Well, it's like, what happened there? I've got to rewind it now. It's like...
Yeah, no, you're right. I have to say, watching the games with the canned noise, it hasn't detracted from my viewing experience in a massive way, to be perfectly honest with you. I've been well able to sit through it. I have flicked over to the other Sky channel to see and get a feel for what it's like to watch the game, and it getting that almost training ground sound and acoustics from the stadium, and I just can't live with that. I can't watch that. I watched a couple of the Bundesliga games in that manner and I had to turn it off. It's just like watching a few lads with a few bibs on running around the park, even though the standard of the football is very good. I really struggle to watch that from a viewing point of view. So I've always had it on this week with the crowd noise. I still enjoyed a couple of the games that had some to offer and didn't enjoy last night's game. But you're right, rustiness is another thing as well, because I think Liverpool, they do thrive on the big crowd and the big event and the way that they play and approach the game with this press and their all-out energy game that Jurgen Klopp has perfected with them so well. But at the same time, they haven't played in 3 months. And they weren't in the best of form before the break either. I think they'd lost 4 or 6 games before the COVID-19 crisis hit. So I'd give Liverpool a pass, to be honest, on last night. I think winning the title in front of the empty stands at Anfield will be an eerie experience, no matter how Liverpool players and management and fans might dress it up. When you've waited this long for the title, for it to arrive in this fashion, I think it's going to take away from it from a little, but 30 years is still 30 years. And obviously the joy of ending that 30 years and drawing level with Manchester United on 20 titles is something they'll relish. But I have a feeling if they came back and won it in front of a packed Anfield in a year's time, it would be a much better feeling and it might even mean something more.
it's hard to know, right? Because, like, for the players, celebrating with the fans is obviously hugely important, and that open top bus ride whenever it happens is something that, you know, you hear stories about in for years and years and years and years to come. At the same time, like, they know they are the best team in the league because they were so far ahead. They were picking up points at a record-breaking pace. They were on track to break all sorts of records that they themselves had set. So Ken Early's making the argument today that they're the greatest Liverpool team of all time, and that's obviously very high praise. I don't think it's going to matter to them too much. Once they get the season ratified and get the medal, then it'll feel to them like they won the league.
Yeah, in the short to medium term, I'm sure there will be a feeling of immense personal satisfaction amongst those players and amongst any member of staff that has played a role in getting them to where they are, because they've been phenomenal. I absolutely love watching this Liverpool team. They never really let you down. They deliver a level of performance that will always have you on the edge of your seat. And I've already referenced the manner in which they play. It's so watchable. And they seem to be a really good bunch of players as well. They've got a very likable manager also. And then you just throw in the stadium and all the history that is associated with Liverpool. I've watched a couple of documentaries in Liverpool over the last week or two, actually. The one on Kenny Dalglish is an incredible watch. But I think that is the medium to long-term feel that the players will get. In the short term, they're going to miss out on so much. My mind is drawn back to the Etihad Stadium in 2012. I was actually at the Stadium of Light in Sunderland the day that United beat Sunderland. And it looked for a few seconds like they were going to win the title. And we know the scenes that took place in the Etihad Stadium with those late goals from Dzeko and Balotelli and Aguero. How could you compare what the City fans experienced that day to what the Liverpool fans sitting at home on their TV will watch Liverpool possibly win it at the Etihad?
Fair enough. But that's the single day where one of the most remarkable things ever happens from a City perspective. It's like a complete bizarre sequence of events. And fair enough, you can't compare We Are City, Super City, with what happens over the course of the season. But if you're a Liverpool fan, you've had this sense of we are the best team in Europe for 12 to 18 months now. It's like, what do you want? The one-off, short, amazing burst, or do you want this long-term sense of we are superstars? I guess the Liverpool fans can let us know this morning. 0879-180-180 yeah. is the number. Gary Breen is with us. Gary, good morning to you. How are you getting on?
Good morning, guys. I'm very well, thank you.
We've started there talking about Liverpool and how, you know, it's a terrible situation they find themselves in. How much are they going to celebrate winning this league title when they eventually do? And my heart bleeds for them as a Villa fan who's watching my team collapse at the moment. Is it going to be in any way diminished for the players, the fact that they win the league, the way they're about to win the league over the next couple of weeks?
I don't think so. Bearing in mind what an achievement it is and how long it's been for the team, of course you'd want to celebrate. And if you think about the parades that Liverpool have when they won that Champions League and stuff, and you feel that, I know Champions League is considered the premier or the biggest title in Europe, but it's a special relationship, the league title for Liverpool, and the fact that they've never won the Premier League is incredible. So it would have been unique. So to be robbed of that opportunity is just one of the things that has happened. It's a shame, but those players will take immense pride, and they should do, because they've been fantastic.
Can we get your impression of the football over the course of the weekend? Maybe we should start with the Merseyside derby. Maybe the best part about this from an Irish perspective is Seamus Coleman and the quality of the football that he put in after a long break. It was great to see, and it was great to see that he's still capable of that.
Absolutely. He looked invigorated, didn't he? And he was everything about his tenacious best, obviously, up against someone like Mane. It's a difficult challenge. But no surprise, really. I don't know him personally, but in terms of his character, it shines through. And every time he plays football, whether he plays particularly well or not. But it was an impressive performance by Everton, notably defensively, because I'd done their last game just before the lockdown away to Chelsea. And Ancelotti adopts his kind of 4-4-2 system that it's quite fluid in terms that it can go to a back three in and out of possession. But in terms of their depth, how they manage the space in and around midfield between both the units, they did it so well against Liverpool, against Chelsea. They were dreadful. Lost 4-0 on the day. Chelsea just picking holes between the lines consistently and exposing them. So you're worried about them. But obviously, we look at Ancelotti. This is a system that served him well. We've seen him do something similar at Napoli. Of course, he got a great result against Liverpool there. But I just think we saw his quality as a manager. We have seen now their players believing in him because he obviously has that aura about him in terms of being an elite level manager. And I think it does bode well for Everton. I think there's a lot of work to be done, but nevertheless, that was an impressive performance.
The Ancelotti thing is actually interesting. I wonder if you're a new manager in a club and you have this weird period of time where you've not got very much to do, you don't have that much access to the players, but you do have access to all of their data and all of their most recent performances, that it's kind of a low-pressure mid-season and next season's pre-season break as well. Are there some managers who are experienced enough to be able to use that to their advantage?
Yeah, well, you would hope so. In terms of the what they have, the kind of different methods of coaching your players, not necessarily just being on the training ground, the fact that you're able to give them all the analysis on their laptops, iPads, whatever they're using, it is a great help. It really is. And if I think about going back coaching now, if I had that tour and a manager was showing me it, because there's different ways you learn as a player, different ways you learn as a child. You might learn visually, verbally, whatever, being having to show practically. So to be able to cover all those bases is brilliant. And I do believe that looking at them, because if you think about Liverpool, obviously their strength is the spacing behind. I didn't think they had that kind of threat so much without Salah. I think Minamino looks to come short, looks to link at 10. So they don't have that searing pace in behind. But nevertheless, Everton defended reasonably deep, trusted their midfield to come back and close that space. So you can see the work that's being done with Ancelotti. And I do believe you see the difference now in terms of his ability. I think certainly the supporters, we're not seeing them yet, will buy into Ancelotti. I think he'll have a lot of support in a way that maybe Benitez has when he went to Newcastle. Not necessarily bearing in mind that Brucey is probably has got a better points return, better win percentage than Benitez has. But the perception is so important in football. And if you suddenly got a manager like Benitez who's come from Real Madrid to Newcastle, or Ancelotti is just a serial winner with all the elite level clubs in Europe, then your fans are buying into it straight away.
What level of ambition should Everton have, do you think, Gary? I mean, obviously, you know, this season is going to be this season, but for next year? Yeah.
Well, I think the ambition is always there. That's the big problem is how realistic it is. Because if you think about the money that the new owner initially ploughed into the club, Marcel Brands comes over from PSV as director of football, does a great job there. So you're thinking, okay, listen, the structure's right. Because so many times with that money, they just wasted so much of that money on buyers that you just thought, really? You want to pay that much for that player? And it started to look a little for me like when QPR had a lot of money initially and were just throwing it about on players who weren't really worthy of it. So I think they have to be clever. And I know there's a lot of talk about getting a new stadium, so that will hit hard. And of course, when Liverpool have been so successful in your city, it is a difficult one. But I think I think with the likes of Ancelotti, I think they will encourage players to come there that they possibly wouldn't have done before. I think the Premier League's a massive pool anyway. And now Ancelotti's there, perhaps they are able to slowly but surely get players that they need to try and bridge that gap. But it won't be easy.
Gary, do you think the way into which Seamus Coleman was playing last night, and in fairness to Seamus Coleman, the break hasn't exactly affected his form because he was playing like that in the few weeks before the suspension and play, that this debate over his position in the Ireland team and the talk around Matt Doherty and everything, when you see him playing like that for Everton and playing as well as he has at any stage before his injury, that there's no real argument as to where Seamus Coleman stands now, that debate is done?
Well, Dave, to be honest, I wasn't surprised that I never was one of those who felt that he was done as such. And I think we're very quick when players get to a certain age to think that, listen, they can't get it back. He certainly have benefited from the break and to recharge his batteries. But it was interesting because I talked about how good they were and how defensively set up and well organised they were. But having Seamus stand at right-hand side, if you remember back to the games just before the lockdown, so Davies playing right back against Arsenal, got exposed by Aubameyang making those out-to-in runs and being caught out, costing him the game essentially, and likewise struggled against Chelsea. But Seamus gives you all that experience, that know-how. So it's great. In an ideal world, I know the debate will always be there. It was noticeable to see him kind of narrowing up as a third centre-half quite a lot. I think there's a lot of talk about could you shoehorn both Doherty and Seamus into that type of system. I'm not sure Stephen Kenny would look to do that. But nevertheless, you just want all your players playing well, and whoever gets the shirt gets it deservedly.
So You're not sure Stephen Kenny will do that, but like it'd be good to see that, wouldn't it? I understand that the sequence of games probably isn't going to allow for a lot of experimentation from an Ireland perspective. But at some point down the line, these players, it'd be great to see them given an opportunity to play in the same team and somehow work out a way of both playing well together at the same time.
Yeah, listen, and I'm sure Stephen Kenny and his coaching staff will be so thorough. That's something I've noticed about him, that they will look at every potential lineup, tactical shape to suit the team. But I've never been one, Joe, I've said this to you before, I've never been one about just shoehorning your best players in. If it is that simple, that black and white, that there's a right back slot available and it's between Seamus and Matt Doherty, then you just pick them. You don't suddenly start thinking, well, listen, can we play him left back and can we get him? It just doesn't work that way, in my opinion.
OK, fair enough. Let's move on to some of the other football over the course of the weekend. Some players seem to have adapted very well and come back very close to top form. A lot of other players are very rusty as well. Yeah. Is that just normal after a break like this? And we're going to be unaware of which players are in good form until maybe 2 or 3 weeks down the line where you're like, okay, now you're getting back to where you're supposed to be.
Well, I think we will certainly be that. But I think even the managers, Joe, have been, in terms of the selections at times, have been strange. They probably got their data through, who's looking sharp, who's impressed in training. Because there's been a lot of team selections where you thought, really? He's not playing? That's a surprise. But I think, yeah, I think you're right. I think usually when you have the off-season break, invariably it's these elite-level players now are probably only getting 3 or 4 weeks at most, considering that they'll have their responsibilities for the national team to play those games. So certainly to have one as long as it has been is a unique experience. All the sports scientists will be having to work it out. But I think you're right. I think certain players have come back quicker. I've always made a point that centre-halves in particular take a bit longer, and not necessarily just for fitness, but I think about timing. I think John Egan, I said that against in his first game back when it looked like Keenan Davis was giving him a bit of problems at centre-half, wasn't picking up the flight. Well, again, we seen it yesterday, although that's never a book in the first one. It's a nonsense that he gets sent off. So I think that can happen. Even talking about your team there, Joe Villa, that was the game that I really focused on watching live over the weekend. That was the main one for me because I wanted to see what Chelsea were like. I thought they were in the driving seat for the Champions League positions. Could they take advantage of the fact that United and Tottenham had effectively dropped 2 points themselves and really make it count? And I was so impressed with them. There were a few signs that they had the same problems, that they were dominating games, but they couldn't make the breakthrough. And I think that's the reason why you're going to see the likes of Ziyech come in, Werner, who are guys who will come from out from in to get strikes on goal all the time. But if you add that to the quality that they have, I know the likes of Willian, Pedro will leave in most likelihood. But nevertheless, Pulisic, Mount was so impressive. But for you, Jer, I think it'd be a frustration for you because it's the second game for Villa. You'd expected them to have looked a bit stronger. But I just looked at them defensively and it's a real concern. Yet they look like they have a good shape in terms of having that back four there, that narrow midfield five. But the space that they gave out wide to Chelsea was incredible. Mm. And it was noticeable to actually watch that because I was looking at Conor Hurren and I was thinking, the amount of times him as an advanced left-side centre midfielder has to go back into left-back and make sliding tackles. And I was looking at it thinking, what is happening here? You've got a narrow midfield. You've got a narrow back four. And yet Chelsea, time and time again, were getting in and spreading out. And I think it's a real concern because Jack Grealish is obviously your best player. But out of possession, they are so vulnerable down that left-hand side. And so often, Connor's having to run back with sliding tackles. There's a couple of occasions in the first half. He gets in that left-back position. He's squared up by Mount. He doesn't want to be there. I think top-class centre-halves don't want to be in those areas against someone as tricky as Mason Mount, but he was there continuing. I think Villa having two home games and being lucky to have got that point, it doesn't look good for them.
No, I think they're screwed at this stage. Just to talk about Chelsea, because you said you'd done the being a good Champions League team like or Champions League qualifying team like the late era Wenger Arsenal, but actually someone who could go toe-to-toe with City and with Liverpool over the next couple of seasons.
Well, I do. In terms of them going forward, I think they're good signings. Ziyech, I've seen so much of him at Ajax. I know what he looks to do on that right-hand side. He'll come in with his left foot and we'll get goals. No doubt about it. He'll get goals from distance. And at times, Chelsea have found deep-line defence is difficult to break down. If you've got someone now who's got that range, gets in around the penalty area and gets sight of goal, he'll punish him. Werner, we know about his pace getting in behind, whether or not the opposition give him that and whether or not he can play in tight areas remains to be seen. But they're good additions, they really are. But the problem remains, and and this is the one thing that I would say in terms of that question, Jerk, can they compete at the top defensively? No, I don't believe they can, because when you think about those title-winning Chelsea teams, defensively so strong, centre-half so good, and I'm looking at those centre-halves yesterday, Christensen, who I like as a centre-half, young, quick, looks after the ball, but they don't have the presence. Rudiger will always have a mistake in him, in my opinion, but they certainly don't have the presence that Chelsea centre-backs have and in the past. And you may counter that, and I'm sure many people will, and say, well, listen, Antonio Conte won the Premier League with Cahill, Luiz, Azpilicueta as centre-half. Yeah, they did. But the reason they did is because out of possession, that back three very quickly became a back seven. They got N'Golo Conte screening midfield. You won't get at them. But that was good. And I think that bodes well in terms of protecting those centre-halves who I don't think are of elite level quality, was the fact that N'Golo Conte reverted back to the position we like to see him best in. And that's patrolling deep midfield and just allowing the likes of the other midfielders mount and to play forward Pulisic. I just like to see N'Golo Conte there. But in answer to your question, defensively is the reason they won't be able to challenge Liverpool and City at the top.
In terms of the top four this season, go on, sorry, Dave.
Sorry, Joe. So do you think, Gary, they actually have the personnel and it's just a question of how they're being coached, that Frank Lampard over the summer can get them in a position where if he puts the likes of Kovacic and Conte in front of that back four or that back three, that they will improve, or they actually need to go out and sign a couple of centre halves that have real presence and maybe have played at a Champions League level? Because we saw in the group stages of this season's Champions League, Chelsea were exposed routinely by pretty average sides such as Valencia, for example.
Yeah, well, listen, in terms of tactically, I think in terms of being as expansive as Frank Lampard will want his teams to be, I don't think personnel-wise they have good enough centre-halves. You're right. And if you think about Liverpool, obviously Van Dijk, but the biggest example of if you take an elite-level centre-half out of your team is Manchester City. Take Laporte out of there and their title challenge just crumbled, didn't it? And we're talking about some of the best players in the Premier League, how good they are in and out of possession. If you ain't got a centre-half who's just in the right area consistently well, then you can't do it. And I look at that and I know they're going to look at situations now where they're talking about potentially getting a left-back in. Chilwell's been talked about, but he ain't going to solve that problem at centre-half, because Chilwell's, if he plays to type like we saw yesterday with that incredible goal he got against Watford, he'll want to be in high advanced areas and creating width in that pitch as a modern-day fullback will be. And because of that, because of the way the modern-day fullbacks play, that they are high advanced areas, there's a massive emphasis on your centre-half to be able to cope with space, but able to just repel the danger and set up another attack. And I just don't trust any of those centre-halves, whether or not it's Christensen, Rudiger, Kurt Zouma, I don't trust any of them to do that.
They're 5 points clear of Manchester United at the moment, as things stand. They're on 51 points and Man United are on 46. What did you make of United's performance on Friday night against Spurs and the situation that they find themselves in, where it looks like they're getting to a point where they have a plan, they just haven't picked their best central midfield together yet? Obviously, Pogba's coming back from injury. So, where are they? What's the truth about Manchester United at the moment?
Well, listen, that's the thing, Jer. What is the truth? What is their best central midfield pairing or three players in there? Because on paper, yes, it's Pogba go in there, of course. And we saw the difference he made when he came out on that second half and the link-up play. I think Bruno Fernandes looks like a brilliant signing. I have not seen him live yet, but I'm so impressed with him. He can take the ball in tight situations. He's able to get his head up, work it to get his strike on goal, can play lovely passes in and around and gives him real composure in that midfield area. So then you think, OK, we'll add Pogba and his skill set in there as well. And you're thinking, you're talking about two quality midfielders. But the big question, and it always will be this question, is not about his ability, Pogba, because I don't think anyone can question that. It's his consistency. It's his actual application as such. And I'm not saying that he's not got his mind right. It's just that when you think about playing centre midfield for Manchester United, it's not necessarily about what skills you have, it's how you influence the game. Now, whether or not you're a Roy Keane and you control it, or a Paul Scholes and you control it, that's what it's about, how often you play and dominate games. Not necessarily about, are you able to flick balls over your head and control it, and that brilliant pass that we saw, you know, that kind of side foot slice pass out to the wing that he'd done in the second half, Paul. But we know about his skill set, but it's whether or not he can consistently do that and whether or not the failings in his game, i.e. staying with runners, looking after the opposition defensively, whether or not they'll be exposed. But I can understand, I know this is going to be a big swell now for people saying, listen, when Pogba comes back, he's going to be sharp with Fernandes and then McTominay, Fred, whoever's at the base. It does look like they've got some real quality. And it does. It does on paper. But it remains to be seen whether or not it has the consistency to show that quality.
Do you think, Gary, that the presence of Bruno Fernandes, I'm asking you to jump inside the mind of Paul Pogba now, which I know is no easy feat, but that when he sees someone like him in the team with them, that it emboldens him and gives him a little more sense that he wants to be part of this because he can see a real attacking picture in the team, whereas before, an awful lot of the attacking responsibility probably he felt was on his shoulders. Or does he see someone that is taking the limelight from him? It looks to me like Bruno Fernandes is already the leader in this team and that might be something that will impinge on the mindset of Paul Pogba.
Yeah, well, my hope would be, Dave, that his reaction will be like, OK, well, I'm going to try and stamp and show you how good I am and to be the top man. Not in a selfish way, but just to say, listen, I'm going to really influence it. You're setting the standard consistently. And he has done, Bruno, in terms of since he's come in, he's been so impressive. And he has made a difference. You think about the impact he's probably having on Pogba, but look at the impact he's having on the rest of the team. The fact that they're giving him balls in tight situations, that they're trusting him, making runs. I mean, that little reverse pass into Martial in and around the box, that link play was so good. Eric Dier gets back to make a sliding tackle to stop what looked a certain goal. But even moments like that as an opposition defender, midfielder would worry you because you're thinking, listen, I'm going to close him down, try and flood him as quick as I can. But he can see you coming. He can play reverse passes. He can play blind. He does look a very good footballer. But that would be my hope, Dave, in terms of Pogba, that his reaction is, oh, brilliant. Listen, this is great. We've got another good player in the building. This bodes well. Will it end up like that? We just don't know.
Obviously, Roy Keane made headlines for his...
Makes headlines every time he speaks.
Yeah.
He's a headline grabber. He's box office. he could tell us the weather and it would be the headline.
He was right, though, about De Gea, wasn't he? And Maguire?
Oh, listen. In terms of the mistakes they've made, but I don't know. To be perfectly honest, I don't know if it's right to be saying, you know, you're going to start swinging punches. Listen, people watching football now is inclusive. I just don't know. I don't know about that. But having said that, I think Roy's very clever. He knows how good how people buy into what he is like as a pundit as such. But I didn't think I was looking in his eyes there and I could genuinely tell you now that was sheer anger. He was furious with those players. You could tell because I think sometimes there's a little bit of a wry smile, a little bit of a giggle after these big comments that he makes. There was none of that there. He was seething and you could see it as soon as Kelly went to him to ask the questions. You could just see he was bullying already and Patrice was just laughing as such. But yeah, listen, you don't need Roy to come out with massive statements like that to tell us that De Gea has been poor and the worry for United people, bearing in mind that he's been a saviour for three or four seasons, De Gea, is that this run of poor form is really dragging on now. It's probably over a season now, isn't it, where he's been making these type of mistakes. On Maguire, listen, if you look at Maguire, and I have seen him since he was a young player at Sheffield United, coaching against him with Peterborough, you always felt you can get at him in terms of that. But yet, every time he made that step up, initially goes to Hull, then he goes to Leicester, and you can't get at him, and he goes to Manchester United, and you go to England as well, internationally, you think you can get at him. But very, very rarely can you. But that was the moment that you do see the weakness, that because of his frame, he's not the quickest. He finds it very difficult to move his feet when he's caught square on. But the reason why he's got to the level is that he doesn't normally get himself into those situations. But he doesn't have the recovery pace of a Van Dijk. He doesn't have the recovery pace of most centre-halves who are quite mobile now. He's a throwback, isn't he, in terms of his physicality. But I still think he's been a brilliant signing for Manchester United. And those type of situations where he does look so cumbersome, so vulnerable, they are few and far between.
There's no chance of... Gary, go on.
Sorry, Jerry. I've a couple of questions on what we were saying about David De Gea. Roy said that he was an overrated goalkeeper. And given that he has been arguably the best goalkeeper in the world at a point maybe about 2 years ago, and people were talking about him as being the best goalkeeper in the Premier League, it seems like a little bit of a farcical argument. But no goalkeeper in the division has made more errors that have led to goals the last 12 months than David De Gea. And you do feel there is a bad mistake in him on an almost game-to-game basis. Yeah. He's still referred to as a world-class goalkeeper. So on that count, wasn't Roy right? He is very much an overrated player at the moment.
Oh, he's not living up to that billion that you've just given there in terms of, and he's certainly not living up to the form that we've seen in previous seasons where he was single-handedly keeping the opposition out. You think about the last time that he played against Tottenham, I think he made 11 saves in that massive win for Solskjaer against Pochettino, which looked at the time a defining moment in terms of getting the job. For that second half, I think he made 11 saves. It was nonsense how good he was. But there's no doubt, and I think I think when you think about Manchester United players, certainly in the generation that I played against, where you never really talked about confidence with them because they were just steely characters. They just churn out the wins week in, week out. But I think he has been massively affected with confidence. This is a goalkeeper that's at times getting booed by his own national team whenever he's in goal. They're not taking to him, the Spanish fans. And then suddenly his form's not particularly good for United. And you add to that the fact that there's a young, really impressive goalkeeper on loan from Manchester United at Sheffield United, Henderson, that's putting pressure on him. I think previously there was no pressure coming from within the building, was there, in terms of the backups? Because you never felt that, even though, you know, they're national team goalkeepers as well, you never felt they were really going to challenge it, partly because of the form that De Gea was in. But now that's all changed. I think there's a big decision to make. And certainly he's going to have to show a lot of character, De Gea, because this is not at the level you associate with him. But unfortunately, as you quite rightly said, Dave, this isn't like a poor month or poor couple of months. This is going on a lot longer than it should do for a goalkeeper of his stature.
If only that fax machine had worked that time that Real Madrid wanted to spend 100 million quid on him, Man United would be quids in and he would have gone. And who knows, maybe he would have maintained the level of performance that they wanted to pay, made them want to pay 100 million in the first place. Gary, great to have you back. Great to have football back. Did you enjoy the experience of watching with the fake crowd noise or with no crowd noise? Or how did you watch it?
Yeah, no, I had a go with both to begin with. I was saying that to Owen over the weekend, and there's no contest. You have to listen to it with a contrived noise, because even then when you're listening to it, I know some of the fans' reaction doesn't kind of normally sit in with what has happened, but it just feels more like a game. I know it's not panning to the stadium, seeing the empty stands, but rarely do you look at the stadium anyway when you're watching on telly. You're focusing on the players, but I'd much prefer it with that fake noise rather than listening to them in a training ground session.
All right, good stuff, Gary. Great to have you with us. Thanks a million. Welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Take care.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.